So hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Now Age podcast with me, Ruby Warrington. I have a very, very special guest on today, special because this person is extremely dear to my heart. I met Lisa Lux, probably coming up on 9-10 years ago now, when she was interning for me in my role as features editor on the Sunday Times Style magazine, which for anybody unfamiliar is a super glossy kind of aspirational magazine newspaper supplement in the UK. And Lisa showed up in the office with a half-shaved head and a pair of DMs and all these big, bold ideas about what we should be writing about. And I was just instantly like, oh, who is this interesting individual? But the official line, Lisa is a British Syrian queer poet, essayist, and performer. And I remember actually getting more of an inkling about like who you really were as opposed to just my intern, Lisa. I don't know if you remember this. We were at somebody's leaving drinks, and I seem to, it was a bar in Camden, and I seem to remember there being maybe a pole dancing situation going on, or at least a podium where some people were drunkenly getting up and dancing. And we were both sitting there kind of nursing a beer, a bit like, oh, what's going on? This is a bit odd, isn't it? You started telling me about your poetry. And I'd never met someone who was aspiring to be an actual poet professionally before. And I just really was like, wow, yeah, okay. I knew a lot of people who wanted to be writers, but poets don't actually exist in the real world, do they? I kind of remember thinking that, but also just being so impressed and intrigued, I suppose, that somebody was going to be actively pursuing that art form as a career and as a way of like having, making your statements in the world. So I'd love, I guess, if you could just introduce yourself to us and to my listeners here a little bit along those lines. Like why has poetry been your art form? How did you find that as a way to express yourself, and why is it so important to you?
So firstly, hi, and that's a really nice introduction that made me emotional. I'm very emotional for this. Oh.
Yeah. It's the dark moon, so to be expected.
As for poetry, I feel that it responds in a very urgent way to both the self and the society, in a way that goes largely, I'd say largely unfiltered when it's performance poetry, at least. And it does aim to capture the great inexpressible. It's like within poetry, or I should say like the best poetry finds like the goddess in the empty tuna can, you know, kind of like finds the abstract in the concrete, and it brings those things together. So I think it's the closest thing that we get almost to a sense of the divine and the dismal, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of creates meaning in things that can otherwise fracture us and create a lot of confusion for us. And as somebody who, I think confusion is the sense of much of our fear and much of our pain. And it's interesting because though poetry is something that many people who don't access it often find to be a confusing art form, it actually somehow in its adherence to chaos creates order. It's like the whole the Apollonian rises from the Dionysian, you know, from the chaos comes order, order comes chaos. And so I think from the way that poetry is formed, you almost find a place to rest in kind of the chaos of it all, and it brings people together in a very urgent manner. Like we're in very politically ugly times.
Charged,
yeah, politically.
But yeah, ugly. It's pretty ugly out there. Let's not like pretend that it's not. Yeah.
It's a bit uncomfortable for many, many people. Mm. And there's a lot of like kind of a, you know, political dissent happening. And at those times, poetry rises because it mobilizes in such an effective way, on numerous levels, you can activate people through poetry. In 3 minutes, I can do to somebody what like you can spend like years trying to do through a novel, which doesn't quite work in the same way so much with like the novel now, because of the way that our minds are, mm-hmm. Our attention spans are shorter. So a poem can just like hit you and wake you up, you know, and even if it only wakes you up for half a day or something, it does it. And on the other side of that spectrum, it can can cure the existential loneliness that we all feel, because somebody stands up and they say, they unzip themselves from the head to toe and show their insides to a room full of unsuspecting people. And those people can look up and say, hey, I'm made of the same stuff too. Like, you know, like, and they can see that we've all got kind of a messy, bloody insides, but at least they all look the same, even if it doesn't always seem that way, you know. It is a medicine as much as it is a mode of activation.
Yeah, you know? It's interesting as you're describing it. I'm thinking it's such a numinous art form, really, and also a very ancient way with words that's actually perfectly suited to the Instagram age. You know, I feel like poetry is having a renaissance because of Instagram, because of exactly what you just said. It's like, here's a way we can carefully construct words that have a very deep and impactful resonance with a person in the time it takes to scroll through to the next post, you know?
Yeah, really, exactly.
Cool. Yeah.
It's funny because it's the most timeless art form, and equally it's what I noticed from traveling a lot with it is, despite the fact that it works on language basis and therefore quite a national and context and what have you, it's somehow the most universal art form. Everybody feels. And that's what it addresses. Pure, unadulterated feeling, you know. This tiny art form, yeah.
That's what I mean about it being a numinous art form. It's literally a human endeavor of vocalizing and verbalizing and articulating deep feeling states, the numinous, right? And now I'm like, this is why we connected over those beers in that pole dancing club all those years ago. Now our friendship and our collaboration has endured actually ever since then, you know? It's been amazing to watch your career develop. And one of the reasons we're communicating and connecting today is because you reached out a couple of weeks ago to let me know about your latest project, which is a music track, a hip hop track called Girl Gang, that you are releasing to celebrate or acknowledge International Women's Day. And then it just so happened that we were able to meet the week of Women's Day, and here we are, and the universe has aligned and brought us together at this moment in time. And I'm really excited to share the track with you. I just got to listen to it, and it's really cool and very inspiring and uplifting. And I want to talk to you all about the inspiration and the other people you've got to collaborate. But first of all, I'd kind of like to chat to you about your thoughts and feelings about the relevance and the need and the value, I suppose, of International Women's Day in 2019. I suppose in a way I have mixed feelings about it. I wonder if the fact that we need to have Women's Day, it's still kind of like imagining women as like an oppressed minority, which yet there is so much oppression of women, of course, but we're actually the majority in terms of like the biological gender split, right, between male and female. And so I'm just kind of, yeah, I don't have any strong opinions either way or the other, but that it brings up some questions for me, I suppose. And I'm curious as to your thoughts about, yeah, the relevance of International Women's Day in 2019.
I think it's like, for me, I keep calling it Feminist Christmas. I'm so excited. It's like my favorite time of year.
Amazing.
And why? Because it's not unlike Christmas in so much as it's a time when you come together and you remember. And you remember your connection and you remember, okay, wait, hang on. The Christmas analogy only goes so far. So let me just break off from that before I trip myself up on it.
Okay.
It's a time of we come together and we remember and we activate each other and we instigate projects, we instigate event series, we instigate conversations, and we do it in a very accumulated way that where there's opportunity for light to be shed upon it and what have you. And as for like was not technically being a minority, like I understand what you're saying, but I think we have to address the fact that I guess minority is in that sense quite a malleable word, because we are very much like a minority in kind of the history books in the cultural conversations and what have you still.
And in terms of representation of power and possession of power and influence.
Possession of power, Yeah, and globally as well, because let's not get lost in the Western sense of it either. For me, it's a time when I feel closest to. I remember again and again my purpose around International Women's Day. Like I remember, like there's chance for us to just touch base with one another and to feel the shared sense of energy. Remember when the women's marches started a couple of years ago, because we spoke around that. We spoke that day. And it's that feeling. It's millions of women marching at once. And whether we're on the street together marching, or whether we're online hashtag marching, or whether we're rolling out projects or whatever, we're marching. And when we come together as one, the kind of power of that communal consciousness, I feel like it's a touching base. It's like a coming back to base, an activation. And then we've got a year to kind of live off the wave of that before we come back together again. And I find it a very exciting time. I find it a time that it reminds me of community. It reminds me of my priorities. It gives me an opportunity to listen well to other women, what they're doing and what their needs are. It also, more often than not, about a month before International Women's Day, I'm like, ah, it's International Women's Day in a month, damn, I need to do something.
It makes right
things that are for the sisters.
You touched on a couple of really important points, actually. One was the idea that we still, however individuals, people's lives may look, we still can never have too many reminders of how much we still need to remember our connection. And we still need to remember that how we're living in modern Western society is by no means a reflection of how women are being treated and how women's issues are kind of elsewhere in the world. So I think that's actually a really important point, you know, the idea of, and this is something I write about in Sober Curious, actually, how, you know, when we consistently numb out with substances or behaviors and even social media when it's used that way, etc., it's a way of disconnecting us from our kind of like lineage of pain, you know. And actually the only way we can really think about making positive change for the future is if we remain connected to that lineage and we do remember and we don't sort of gloss over what struggles might have come before us, you know. And we actually remember what work is still to be done. So that's a really important point.
Exactly that, actually, like opening our eyes and reminding us of the kind of the global position at where we're at and where we need to go from here. It's almost like a great big day of forum, you know, come together. And if you do it right, you learn a lot from International Women's Day, as much as you output as well, you know?
Yeah, the listening piece is so important, right? Really kind of like using it as an opportunity to remind ourselves again, or to remember again, the importance of listening and the importance of bearing witness to the stories and experiences of others, rather than focusing purely on what we're here to contribute. We hear so much, don't we, about like everybody can have a voice, everybody can have a platform, everybody can speak up, you know, because of social media. However, yeah, we also need to still really be listening for what we don't still know, you know.
I think the biggest contribution that we can make to the world is to listen better.
Yeah.
To listen better, both to many things on many levels. I think listening is the most, is a very active pursuit, and something we should be focused on a lot more. Like, we have platforms, yes, great. Doesn't mean we have to be out putting through them. We can also be using them to share others' voices and things like that as well. I think sharing platforms is a big thing as well. And whilst we're talking about kind of the global nature of things, I'm thinking about this a lot lately, actually, about global sisterhood, and how we generally, there's a fractured sense of feminism, which is that like your feminism is this kind of feminism and that doesn't contain us. And there's a very, there's a lot of severing. And I think it is done to us. I think it's a rhetoric that is fed to us that we then somehow take on and allow ourselves to be broken off from each other, rather than, and it comes from when we're talking more than when we're listening. Like you can always listen to others. You can't talk for them, and not everything you say is going to cover their life, their experiences. But what the universal practice is, listening, right? And at the end of the day, there has to be, we have to believe in a global sisterhood, because if we don't, we allow that fracturing to continue, and then it's not going to get anywhere. We're just going to break off, break off, break off. It's a very weak movement, you know. So yeah, we are all moving from the same core place, which I think is something that you touched upon, and that whole coming back to and remembering one another and remembering the world over one another's struggles, or not remembering, learning, educating ourselves, realizing that our core drive as sisterhoods, as feminists, as believers in a better world, is to create safety, emotional, physical and spiritual safety for everybody. And that's our drive. It's not like the particularity of my fight right now isn't how I identify. I identify with the drive, and I can see that in you. I can see that in somebody else, and somebody else, and somebody else, despite the fact our rhetoric or our Instagram feed look different.
Yeah, right. Although we might have a different, have had a different experience as a straight, cisgendered white woman. I have a different experience from you as a queer identifying woman, you know? So yeah. And that's where, I mean, you know, the word intersectional, I like the way you use the word fractional in kind of like in the same sort of a sense though, but the word intersectional is something that's come very much more into kind of mainstream parlance around the concept of the feminist movement, right? And you describe Girl Gang as a celebration of intersectional feminism. I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit more about the Girl Gang project, like what was the thinking and what's the message in it as it relates to this idea of an intersectional feminism that is also still collaborative and still about a sisterhood. To get just a little bit complicated and nuanced.
Let's see how we can contain it all. So, I mean, the track came, I actually wrote it a few years ago, and I've been dreaming of the video ever since I wrote it. And it came at a time when I was really in a tough place, and my sisterhoods from all over the world, my sisters from all over the world, I should say, turned up. Whether they, like, not that I reached out to them, just somehow they knew to turn up, you know? It's kind of like great unspoken of like, somehow we're all connected in a way that we can't see. Then in that numinous way that we're all connected to one another, and we feel each other, and there is some web pulling us all together. And this inspired the song, and the song is a high vibe feminist hip hop anthem that's about like home being like your girl gang, home being your sisterhood. It comes from that notion that wherever you are in the world, no matter whether you're separate from them or whatever, if you have them, then you can feel at home. Like if you feel that sense of women supporting women, then anywhere can feel safe, you know. Except in much in less charged language than that, and it's just kind of quite fun. But that's the vibe of it. But then the video, what the video gave me space to do, and was, we did an open call to women the world over to send in footage of them with their girl gangs, whatever that meant to them. That could mean them and their daughters. That could mean them and their, you know, their colleagues, their like gal pals. It could mean their, you know, their comrades, whatever. But then to send in footage of them doing whatever they do with their girl gang, right? So they did, and we got footage from everywhere, like really, like from everywhere. We got footage from across the UK. We got footage from Namibia. We got footage from California. We got footage from across the Middle East. We got footage from Australia, from Canada, all sorts of people doing their thing in their way that they do it. And it just becomes this visual ode to how, what's beautiful, sorry, I should say, before I talk of the outcome, is that how keen and willing people, women the world over, wanted to be in investing in this single contained vision of us all together, of us all kind of coming together, how their separateness captured would be brought into illustrating how it's all about how we all feel the same thing. The feeling, the people, the small groups of people who I've showed the video to already have said, you know, like our executive producer, Tanya Safi, like her take on it was, I've always loved women, but I feel like I'm just realizing quite how much I love loving women. you know, from the video. And somebody else said, it just feels like watching it is, I'm hanging out with my girl gang, yet I'm watching women who I don't know their experience. There's women like in a tribe dancing in Namibia together. We don't know that experience, but it's all contained within this one visual that just becomes, that has just captured the sense of wherever you are, whatever it is you do together, how good does it feel to just love each other and support each other? And let's just capture that. That's the source of it, the feeling, not the thought. The thought fractures us. The feeling is what's universal, you know?
I do know. And I'm getting really emotional just listening to you say this, because I can feel it, like as you're describing it. I haven't even watched the video yet, but I know the feeling that you're talking about. And again, it's back to that numinous piece. I don't have the words, that feeling. Yeah, I describe that feeling as home. I teach a lot about moon sign astrology, as you know. You're a founding member of Moon Club, which I started with Alexandra Roxo several years ago, who I think is featured. But I teach a lot about moon sign astrology, and when I'm asking people to connect to their moon, the feeling of the moon or the part of the moon that is ruled by their chart, I ask them to imagine the feeling of home. And that feeling of home is something that we all know, but it will look very different for all of us. It will smell very different for all of us. The people who are there will be very different for all of us. But the feeling of home is something that's just like, oh, it's just so intrinsic to our being. And it is a feeling of safety, you know? Yeah. And for some of us, we may not have experienced that in our lives nearly as much as is our birthright. And I think that's part of what you're saying, right? It's like we all are born with the right to feel home. Yeah. And for so many of us, we haven't been able to experience that. But when we find people, sisters, it's a very unique sort of a thing that happens when women come together to be able to create that sense of home for each other.
Right. And also, I think it's important to focus on the fact that, like, you might not have found it yet. Mm. That might be out there. Like, I know women contacted and were like, I wanted to send in a video, but I don't have a girl gang. Mm. And it's like, oh, you do. We are all it. You do. Like, we just have to open up to it and create more and more spaces for it. And that's like our role as women who are clued into it, to keep creating these spaces where they aren't, where they're not already, to keep creating them, to show them that you do have a girl gang. You just don't know their names yet. Mm. That's, know? Mm. And also, and I think it's also on the notion of safety as well, that how do you create safety in the world? Well, you don't fight the threat. That's not how you create safety. I think you become safe space. That's how you create safe space in the world. You become it.
I love you that. You become almost like a womb space. metaphorically, right? You know, it's like we all come from that space. That was our initial experience of safety and of being held, of feeling held. You know? Yeah. I love it. So tell me about some of the people who wound up collaborating on a deeper level.
Well, okay. So on the actual structural level of it, like, I got to collaborate with the Records Out through Saving Grace Records, by the way, were independent record label who have just been so supportive and so amazing in actualizing this dream. So I just want to say the process of working with Saving Grace is like credit where credit's due. I felt so held and looked after. Mm-hmm. And then the executive producer is a fellow queer Arab, Tania Safi, who is just a pleasure to know. And she's a video creator, and a lot of people the world over are grateful for her existence in this world. A lot of people feel safer in this world for the fact that she exists and exists loudly. And so I'm so proud to work with her in this capacity as well. And then as for the video, some of the women, I don't want to name the people whose names are out there in the world over the people whose names aren't, and say they're more important in our video, because there are people whose names I don't know in the video, and they are equally as important to me as the people who've got like 2 million followers on Instagram, you know?
Totally know what you mean, yeah.
But some of the recognisable faces that folk can look out for is like Selma El-Wadani, who's a poet who's an incredible poet, and she's also Egyptian-Irish poet, actually, who can be found on Instagram. And Grace Neutral, who owns Femme Fatale tattoo shop, which really again champions women in the tattoo industry, and who's just an icon. We've got Suki Whitehouse and Poppy Jamie as well, like they run the brand that, that's based on their friendship, in that sense. Yasmin Abdul-Majiad as well. Oh, the list goes on and on. We've got Alexandra, of course, she champions like women coming together through Moon Club and all of that support network and that global sisterhood. And then so many women whose names that we don't know, that I don't know, and that we can't speak of here, but who have brought so much to the video and who are just in equal measure, I'm honoured to have sharing the space with. And this is what I love about the video, that like it is a global collaboration. People went out and shot their video to send in. It's a global collaboration, and ain't that what sisterhood is? You know,
yeah, absolutely,
something together, you know, and having kind of our input and our mark put upon a final vision of what we can create together when we come together, you know.
I want to actually backtrack just a little bit and talk a bit more about this safety piece, because I think it's such an important piece in the now age and in this digital age and in this fraught political space that we find ourselves, you know. I think a lot of people are feeling not very safe in the world for whatever reasons. And I love the idea that with intention, perhaps we can become, just by our presence, a safe space for people. Can you speak a little bit to that process and like what it actually means to create safe space just by being in the world, by the message the energy you're putting out in the world? Does it take more than that? Like, is it about vocalizing things in a certain way, or how can you make the world feel a safer space for people?
What I've realized, and I wrote a piece for Numinous about my marriage to myself, right? And that for me was part of the act of becoming safe space in the world, because what my biggest drive in renewing my vows to myself in December was the vow to unpick my insecurities, because I was really, really observing how my insecurities, how I interpreted that the world could hurt me, was how I was becoming a hurtful person. Okay. I wasn't able to be there, to be loving in every possible situation, if I was afraid that that situation was going to cause me pain, if I was kind of acting from a place of insecurity in that way, I could no longer be a safe space. When I needed this, when I needed that sense of safety, then I was becoming a threat in that way. Do you know what I mean?
So Could you give me an example?
Of course, yeah. I mean, in a very personal, I'll try give a couple for reference, but like, yeah, in a very personal sense, and particularly as a queer woman, I say this, but as a queer woman in a romantic relationship, if I have an insecurity about, for example, how you could hurt me, or maybe you don't feel what I need you to feel, or maybe you're rejecting me. And if I think that you're rejecting me in some way based on my insecurity, not based on how you're expressing yourself, based on how I'm interpreting it, as is everything.
Yes.
I will act hurtful towards you.
I see. You see? As a way of creating a defense, protecting yourself, quote unquote, protecting yourself from getting hurt. It's almost like I'll hurt you first.
I'll hurt you first. I'll push you away so that you can't push me away. If I kick you first, then that slows you down and I can run.
I heard a phrase yesterday that's reminding me of this. I can't remember what it was in. It's like some TV show or movie. I honestly can't remember. Maybe it'll come back to me. But someone described the other person as being like an emotional porcupine. Yeah. And I think that's sort of what you're describing. It's like, yeah, I'm going to put out all these prickly feelings to kind of protect my soft, mushy, like insecure, slightly wobbly self on the inside, you know. Yeah.
And it also fails at is recognizing that like love like being in a loving state, not the act of loving, but being in a loving state as consistently as one possibly can is the ultimate self-defense as well. Because if you remain in a state of love, then you can't be destroyed, you know, you can't destroy yourself. You can't, and you can remain in a generous space, and there's abundance in that. It's not going to run out of love, which is a great thing to realize. Yeah, you can just keep creating it, you know. That's in a romantic sense, and you can imagine how that translates in a friendship sense, how that translates in a work sense, particularly kind of work we do, creative, emotional labor kind of work. Mm. If I think that there's somebody else's ego involved, and I think that that's putting me in it, that's creating a social dynamic between us that's meaning that, like, I am less powerful, and that, you know, you see our insecurities start acting up and they talk like this, right? And as soon as you start doing that, like, you're creating threats to the world. You're making things uncomfortable for yourself, for other people, for those who come into contact with you. You're perpetuating fear.
Well, divisiveness and instability and insecurity. Yeah.
And then on the public sense, it's like, you know, I could post something that's quite vulnerable, and that is quite revealing, that, like, you and I both know when we do these things, when we do them, of course, with emotional intelligence, that it offers medicine, and as I said before, that cure of existential loneliness, and it gives people chance to feel held and seen and to come together and create community. Or you're feeling insecure about it, and you put yourself out there in a different way that instead shows you as some, like, you know, like, polished, like, I've got this. That what it does, your insecurity breeds and creates more insecurity.
I see, you know, yes. Because people consuming that or seeing your message will start comparing themselves perhaps unfavorably with this projected kind of persona that you're putting out there. Yeah, right. I get it. That makes sense.
Yeah, it happens in event space, how we hold event spaces, how we try and navigate our ego, how our ego, bless us, is just this dog that we need to train, because it will look after us if we train it well, you know, but, like, otherwise it'll just run riot and, like, bite the hell out of everybody around it.
Yeah, while barking our own house down as well, like, never giving us any rest.
Yeah, pissing everywhere, you know.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah, that's I've never heard that analogy before. How have you managed to train your ego? You're an Aries like me. Yeah, my ego, I'm very present with my ego. I'm in a constant dance with my ego, and the social media space is really tricky for me, actually, because I find it really is, like, where all of this stuff gets to get played out, you know, and I can really feel the difference on days when I'm feeling, like, insecure and putting stuff out there to come across a certain way, and the days when I'm feeling just really safe in myself and, like, I just want to share what's in my heart, like, the feeling is very different, I suppose. And so, yeah, having books out is quite a good way to get to know your ego as well, you know. Is this about people liking my book and good reviews and people liking what I do, or is this really about the message I'm putting out, and actually who gives a shit about the reviews, as long as it's reaching the hands of people who need it? And it's a dance I find myself doing still, you know, because we're so ingrained to measure ourselves by likes and by, you know, material external success, I suppose.
Well, that isn't even about me, like, or me, that I, because it's like somebody asked me the other day in a podcast, like, do you write for yourself, that age-old question, do you write for yourself or do you write for others? And I'm like, well, that's based on the notion that I am different to others, that those two are mutually exclusive. Like, I am of them. If I'm serving them, I'm also serving me. If I'm just serving my ego, I ain't serving either of us. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that's not a person that exists. I, the self, exist en masse with the others. We are all one thing. The ego, that ain't human. That's just something that should exist alongside me. You know what I mean? It shouldn't be served in its own right in that way. But how I work with my ego, I don't know. It's a lot. But, like, on that, on a similar sense of what I was saying, for example, my best friend, oldest friend, Taz, she, for example, around New Year, she got upset with me because we'd had a really, I'd misheard something she said on the phone. I thought that I'd tracked her down by her home phone because I couldn't call her by her mobile and la, la, la. And eventually I tracked her down and I thought she'd said, you know, boundaries. And I was like, oh God, I'm being really pushy. Like, I mean, pushy. So I like backed off for a few weeks and kind of like pulled back and thought I would let her like, you know, come to me and what have you, because she was obviously feeling she had this boundary. Anyway, turns out she was really upset with me because I disappeared for this time when she really, really needed me in her life. And as we spoke, and it turned out, as it transpired, she didn't say boundary. She said, found me.
But what
came after that was she was obviously mad because she'd got pent up and she'd got angry and she needed to express her anger at me. And I know her very well, and I know that she needed to express it. So despite the fact we unpicked the mistake and I apologized wholeheartedly still for my part in pulling back and not being there for when she needed me, she heard me. I'm sorry. She's like, okay, you know, but still, and continued with her anger. And this is when it became clear that what happened was her insecurity of the situation had made her be nasty towards me. She thought I was rejecting her. So she then in turn got really short and shirty with me to the point that she had to then really put me in my place and tell me. But how the ego does, what I wanted to do is be like, was be angry back, and Aries, I wanted to throw my fire.
Mm.
But I cared about her too much. And it's that, it's tapping into the care beyond the self. Like, no way, I love you too much. I'm going to let you be angry at me. I'm going to take it. I'm going to hold space. I'm going to ask you, what do you need? Darling, what do you need? Where do we go? Let me see you later. Let me hug you. Let me show you how much I love you. And give that and care beyond it. And that's how I'm trying to get past the ego. So the ego is like, thanks, ego. Thanks, darling. You're trying to protect me, but stay, dog. Sit.
Yes.
This isn't a time when I need you to protect me.
Yes.
There will be times, but this isn't it. I suppose it's just caring. It's caring enough for others. And then in our public sense, it's caring enough for the audience that we trust and who trust us. I care enough for you to not let my ego come and bite you in the ass on days when you've got enough of every other ego in the world playing out. And that is by absolutely no means saying that I've got my ego totally under control and I'm cushy-cushy and I've got this. I ain't.
Well, yeah, I think it's something we're all working with, as so many more of us are stepping into this space of public figure, have a voice, like have a platform, being seen, you know?
But hey, don't you feel, do you ever find it that because you... we talk, we have these conversations and we have them publicly and that you almost feel held against, you almost feel that it can be used against you in some sense as well. Like, you know, I've had people for example, would be upset with me on a personal level who would then say, I don't see how you can talk about sisterhood if you've upset me. Do you know this? Mm. Is this recognizable? And I find this... it's why I always preface this, like, I don't know, I still don't know, like, I'm having this conversation with you and I feel the need to make the point that, like, I'm just consistently becoming.
Yes, right, exactly, you know? You're just being.
I'm never claiming to have become, is the point,
right? Yeah, right.
No one thinks I've become, but I mean, I'm not claiming to have become at any point, but when we have these conversations, these dialogues, it's just because we're kind of helping each other in our process of becoming and, like you say, being.
Yeah, and just being, exactly. And really kind of like accepting and or being all the different parts of ourselves. And it's a new and a different space for us to be navigating as humans and as women and as feminists. And I'm really happy you sort of touched on the emotion of anger. This is something that's come up in a few of the conversations I've been having on this podcast recently. And just in my own life personally, this year I really have felt very connected to my anger in ways that I haven't necessarily before. I've always shied away from that emotion. I spoke to a guy, Will Stew, a couple of weeks ago, who even thinks that he's a psychiatrist, anger is not really a proper emotion. It's a sort of a mask for other emotions we might be experiencing that are actually more difficult, more complicated and more painful for us. So anger then steps in as this sort of shield in a way. But I sort of feel like anger is an emotion that definitely gets people heard and on social media, and definitely kind of like riles people up. And I feel like a lot of our news media is very specifically designed to incite people's anger. And I just, yeah, I'm curious if you have any more to share about kind of how we can use our, feel our anger, not deny it, not be in disavowal of our anger, but not let it get the better of us and not let it stymie some more productive conversations that we can have, particularly around sisterhood and how to support each other. And I guess I mentioned that specifically because it comes up, you know, we've all heard the term like angry feminist. It's kind of, you know, no, almost like no one wants to be that. And yet at the same time, like, well, yeah, of course, we need to be angry if we're feminists. There's so much to be angry about. But I'm seeing a lot of that anger being turned, women turning anger against each other for not necessarily understanding, you know, or for stepping out of their zone into an area where sort of like help support might not be so appreciated. Do you still see what I'm talking about?
I do, yeah. And I think anger is magic.
Hmm.
I think it's magical. I think it's a force, and like all forces, it comes from you know, it's a magical place. I use magic in the sense of it's quite something to marvel at, and it's a creator. It can make something from thin air. Can magic, a magician. But yeah, we do turn it against one another, and I think it's because we don't practice enough. Where's this anger from? Am I actually mad at you? Am I actually mad at you, or am I mad at something else? And I'm just kind of using this as a really great opportunity to get that out, because I need it to get outside of my body now.
Because otherwise, you know, I may turn it against myself and hurt myself. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I think once we like learn how to channel it into what it's actually here for. Like, I actually wrote this piece. I wrote a couple of pieces actually. It was one piece, but split into two. Trust Your Outrage, it was called. It was a two-part series of the same notion. And essentially that, like, you know, people will say to me, yeah, exactly what you said, you're angry feminist and la, 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 and this, that, and the other. And it's like, well, one, you're damn right, I am. And you would say, what made you so mad? What made you so mad? And they want that scandalous top line. They want that. They want the scandal. They want, you know, you to tell you something that happened to you on this personal level. And yes, we all have those stories. We do, and they live within us. And we just have to like grow our skin over these bloody tumors that live inside of us. And we just have to keep growing atop them. Yes. But also, do you know what? Their anger existed before I did. Mm. Like, I was born with my fist up because I was born woman. Like, I was in the seed of the women that I came from, you know, who have had so much put upon them that I live now in the shadows of the shame that was cast upon them still, you know, and that's what I'm rising from. That's what I'm rising from, you know. So, no, I'm probably not mad at you, sis, because you didn't put, like, the jar, you know, the jar of whatever away. Yeah, right. I'm mad at, I've just got anger. And like you say, there's so much anger there's so much provocative media that tries to lure that anger out of us so that we do turn it on one another. So that also the media being a very confusing place, so that it incites anger, but then it incites, as I said before, that sense of confusion, which we don't really know what to do with it. So we just spit it out at whatever it tells us to spit it at, rather than actually getting in touch with the more spiritual nature of it and how it links us to our ancestors and how we are but a force of them.
I like that. And so we can then, I think what you're saying is actually learn how to channel our outrage as an energetic force that can actually be used in the world as a way to right what wrongs might have been done in the past, or at least spur us into action. Right. I think that, I mean, we saw a huge, you know, we saw that with the women's marches, right? People were so angry about what happened when Trump got elected that we saw this huge outpouring onto the streets. And actually, what I was very nervous about attending the women's march in New York, because I thought it might feel like a dangerous space, but it didn't. It felt completely safe. And actually, what came out was not what took to the streets was not an angry mob, but a very loving and supportive mob, that it came from a place of anger or outrage, right?
But then the two things aren't mutually exclusive, to use that term again. Like, we kind of assume anger, and I'm talking about it within the context of this, so this can't be misconstrued, but we assume anger and rage to exist at the opposite end of the spectrum to love and kindness, and mm-hmm. they don't, not in sisterhood and not in feminism, they don't. Like, I held an event in Beirut on Saturday called the Sisterhood Salon, and there was a lot of rage. There was a lot of rage that we needed to get off our chest. And it was a poetry event, but particularly with discussion element to it. So we discussed the work that the artist presented, and there was four of us reading poems. And then we discussed where we're at and where we go from here. And within that, we outed sexual harasser, a very current that week, sexual harassment case, very publicly outed it and talked about where we're going from there. There was a lot of rage. Not everybody in the room spoke the same language. So one person said in the discussion how she noticed she didn't always know what we were saying because her English wasn't quite good enough, but she felt it because she saw how intensely we were channeling it and we were physicalizing it. And there was, she felt, she was journeying with us despite the fact the language wasn't telling her the particularities. And then this man in the room, separate to her, said that he realized what he learned from the process of watching us was that there's a lot of work that men need to do, that people need to do to be worthy of our love. And these two opposing things coming from that same room drew my attention to the fact that not just what they said, actually, but I just think that captures well the energy of the room, if I can, in the short space of time we have, capture what happened that day. But the level of intensity that we each contributed to and stirred the cauldron of, and we came with such rage, what it led to was so many tears and hugs and loving each other. Like, one sister stepped up and she said what had been done to her that week, and she spoke of her rage until she was shaking, until the room was shaking. Now, what I'd done, knowing she was going to do that, was write a poem of respect for her, because I knew that I would be going on after her. So I prepared this surprise for her that was just an absolute, this is how we see you, you martyr of our whole culture and our whole movement. And read this to her so that she felt entirely held and loved and supported, knowing that I was going to be leaving the country later that night. I wanted to have a lasting impression of how much, how she is seen within the arms of us all, you know. And from that anger bred the opportunity for me to show her love. And that's what happens from our rage, from expressing our rage at what has been done to us. We have the opportunity to show one another how much we love each other, and we are there for each other, and we hold each other. I hold you, sis, because I feel you and I get you, and I know what I needed, and I needed arms, so here's mine, you know. So from anger can come love. From anger can come love. And that, my God, if that's not what we're aiming for, then it's waylaid anger.
That's an amazing message, because in a way, in that sense, the anger is masking a deep vulnerability and a need to be loved and to be held, you know, and you responding in that way is just so, so beautiful. And I think it's, you know, perhaps when we see angry outbursts on social media or whatever that can feel spiky and prickly and like that emotional porcupine, I think it's just a reminder, isn't it, to see it as like, that's masking a very deep hurt. And actually, what does a hurt need but love?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And again, we're not always going to be in the position to offer hurt to something that feels it's going to hurt us either. Yeah. And that's a very nuanced conversation that would never happen.
To offer love to something that feels like it might be going to hurt us. Yeah.
It might hurt us. Something can offer love to it, and we can trust that we'll find it, and we can trust that we'll find love. We're not always in a position to offer it ourselves, but when we are, I think like that we will never, ever, ever feel like we wasted our time by doing so.
Yeah.
You know, not only do we give from that, but we obtain so much from the practice of finding that abundant well of love, in which we realize that we'll never run out of it, you know?
You said something really interesting then, which was, it'll never feel like a waste of time. And I think so much, and this is something that comes up for me frequently, what we're talking about, the kind of bonds we're talking about creating, the kind of nurturing we're talking about giving each other, the kind of sisterhood we're ultimately talking about creating, is not something that happens overnight, and it's not something that happens with the click of a like. It's something that takes time, consistency, effort, discomfort, like you explained the, you know, the situation with your friend. It's time that we took the time and realized what an incredible investment we're making when we take the time, and we don't just try and rush through things onto the next kind of adventure or the next feel good situation. When we actually can take the time to sit in what feels shit is when we can actually really begin to repair it and create these bonds and this true sense of safety and togetherness that you're talking about, I think.
And I think that's the most actually anti-patriarchal thing we could ever do, because the patriarchy that makes us think like, gotta keep it moving, sis, you gotta keep going, gotta keep
days off, the city day off.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. Are you relaxing? Let me ruin that for you. Like that. But actually, the most anti-patriarchal thing, therefore, that we can do is take our time and really, 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 really invest all that we've got in building sisterhood instead, because the payoff will be that we don't have to move so fast anymore after all.
Yes. You know? I love it. Long term, big vision. But yeah, that's where we got to go. We gotta go. Can you tell me a little bit more about your work in Beirut?
Yeah, I'd love to. So, as you know, I started going there. Not that it was the first time going there, because my dad grew up there, so we have family there, and I've been like weddings and things before. But I started on this journey about a year and a half ago. Being of Syrian descent, I felt quite like it was my duty to understand better what was going on and to go and see that. And I couldn't get to Syria, and I'm still trying again with my visa application today. Mm. But maybe I shouldn't say that.
we can do that.
That little bit easier, yeah. Yeah. but yeah, I started going to Beirut to be closer to the refugee camps and what have you, so that I could see firsthand what the situation was and where things were at with the Syrian crisis and the Syrian war. Mm. But in doing so, like, I was also, I guess, trying to figure out what my identity was. I wanted to get to Syria because I wanted to know better what the void in me looked like and where it came from and the land on which it came from. And I believed that by visiting Syria that I would be able to know better myself, or know better like the parts of myself I'd never met. And that wasn't possible. And Syria wasn't of the land anymore. It wasn't contained there. It was contained in the camps. It was contained in the scattering. So I tried to meet that, and then eventually wound up on this journey of deconstructing identity for myself, diaspora identity, as well as the identity of a adopted child. So kind of twice displaced. But meanwhile, I got there, and I also just kind of started setting up a life for myself. Like, I came so happy and so content there. Like, that place, I swear to you, it's on ley lines or something. I don't know. There really is some magic. I started doing shows there and doing a lot of workshops, and found the queer community there, and found the sisterhood there, and fell in love there, and all of these things, you know. So like, I just I go out there, and I'm working on a book right now called Honey Eyes. Mm-hmm. And it's about this journey, and it was funded by the Arts Council, which I'm so grateful for that. And it's about this journey and how I began it, thinking that Syria was the father that I was to meet, and I was determined to meet this fatherland, because I believed the land itself to kind of be a man that would be able to reflect me in some way. And what accidentally happened was I actually accidentally met my birth father by a lighthouse in Beirut. And
you actually did
actually met the actual human person.
That's incredible. Wow, Lisa. Mm. That's like a whole other podcast situation to dive into, but wow, yeah. Wow.
So it's been quite a trip the past year and a half.
Yeah.
It's been a lot. and ever in my life imagined that I'd meet him, which is, I guess, why I turned a whole water on land into a person. I somehow felt like a water on country was easier to access than a man, who'd like been party to my existence somehow, but who I just didn't see as a possible. I just didn't cross my mind that we'd ever be in contact. Mm. And we found each, well, he sent a letter. The first time I was out there, when you helped me, when you put the article out to help, when I was looking for donations to go, that during those 2 weeks that I went out, that first trip, I got back, there was a letter waiting for me from him. He didn't know my name. He didn't even know my full name. It was passed on to me. So it's not like he knew that I was there. It was just the universe folding like origami.
Oh, isn't it amazing how it does that when we really listen to that deep call and we actually pay attention and we actually take what might feel like some precarious, brave steps towards actually pursuing it. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about that journey is because we hear in our tumultuous times so many people saying, what can I do to help? What can I do? Really feeling like we want to contribute something or do something for a very small percentage of the population. Does that actually look like going to somewhere where things are the worst and seeking to do what we can? And I think I wanted to kind of, yeah, just hear from you as to what it was. Yes, you have a personal connection to something in your lineage that drew you there as well. But I wonder, it's really heartening, I think, to hear that a journey which might look on the outside kind of perilous can actually turn up such rich kind of personal gems in the process, you know?
Yeah, for sure. It's like, because for me, my drive was to tell a different story of Syria. Mm. Like I the only reason I put on the first few words of my bio British Syrian isn't because I feel a great claim to a land that like is so war torn that not all of us can claim part of it like that. There's not enough to go around anymore. Mm. Right? Why do I do that? Because in the UK, where I live and where I am and where I am constantly consuming the media of, the only way that anybody knows what Syria even is through tragedy and trauma. Mm-hmm. And that is not the narrative of that place. It is not. I know that much, at least. I know that it is not. It's not the narrative of anything holistic. That's not the whole of anything. And I want to tell a different story. I want you to hear the word Syria in a different context. And I'll never be able to take it out of the times that we're in. I ain't writing no history books. That ain't my job. No, but I can write it through the lens of my longing and my love for a place. I can write it through my personal sense. I can write it through the way that I carry it forward in me, whether people like that or not, you know, mm-hmm. It's contained in me, and I will carry it forward, and I will learn of the culture better and better and better and continue to do so, to carry it forward, to continue planting seeds of Syria onwards in a way, in a positive way.
Story medicine, Lisa, story medicine, literally like telling the story of a war-torn place to give it a different identity and give it a different hope, a different future, to help give it a different future.
Exactly. Yeah. But, and also, like, no one can care about somewhere that they only, you're asking about people, like, you know, being removed and what they can, how they can think about a place. Nobody really can give a crap about somewhere that they see in a two-dimensional manner. If you only hear about a person who's just traumatized, you don't know how to care for them. You don't know what's beyond it. You don't know what you're caring for. You don't know what you're trying to deliver them back to or from or whatever. Mm. Like, that's it. Like, to hear the other side of Syria, to hear the other side of many of these places that we only hear the trauma of, is to actually care about them and understand them and understand why you should invest in them and why you should seek out more truthful media. And, you know, why you should be more acutely aware of what's going on, because these are magical lands.
Mm. You know? And then we can zoom in and apply that to an individual human being as well. How can you care about a human being who you haven't really fully, coming full circle again, listened to the full story and the full fullness of that person's experience? How can you really care about someone you just see on social media looking past until you've actually really? And I think it's one reason why podcasting is becoming so popular, because we want to hear the fullness of people's stories. We don't want an edited version that's got some kind of an agenda that's being presented by a magazine that largely exists as a vehicle for advertising to sell us stuff that we don't need. We actually want real stories from real people, so we can feel really connected to each other, you know?
Absolutely.
To bring it back full circle to where we met. And the kind of stories we thought we were going to be telling. Yeah. And now look at us. I love this. Lisa, it's been so, so wonderful to connect with you today. I'm going to share links to all of, I'll share links to all your articles on the Numinous, as well as links to the track. Can people purchase it? Is there a financial piece to this as well? Can people buy the track?
Yeah, they can. It'll be on all streaming platforms, and then it'll be on like Apple Music and stuff, like, I don't know, places where songs go.
All right.
And then the video will be on YouTube.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, we'll share all the links, and happy Feminist Christmas, babe.
Happy Feminist Christmas, Ruby.
I'll see you really soon.
I hope so.
Bye. What a brilliant human being Lisa is. You can tell why she's one of my favorite people to talk to about women's issues in particular. And this seems like a really good point to announce that Alexandra Roxo and I are going to be hosting a retreat specifically themed around cultivating feminine leadership qualities. It's called Manifesting the Matriarchy, and it's going to be taking place over Mother's Day weekend in the US, May 9th to 12th at the 1440 Multiversity in Santa Cruz in California. That will be a 3 to 4 deep dive into really kind of empowering the feminine within us and empowering our feminine leadership qualities, like I said. I'm going to include the link for that in the show notes as well. Definitely check us out. If you're on the West Coast of America, please come join us. That is all from me this week. Thank you for listening. This podcast features original music and is edited by alloaudio.com. www.alloaudio.com